Okay, we are recording. Good. All right, Erev Tov. I think it's appropriate to this week, sort of the eve of Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaTzmud. We just had Yom HaShoah, so we can think in terms of maybe just dedicating this year to the memory of so many people that we think about this time of year. When it comes to Yom HaZikaron, I'm always reminded of a funeral that I went to in Israel, an army funeral. I've never seen anything like that in my life. It was a young man who, in fact, his father's well known, Alman, the guy who won the Nobel Prize. His son was killed in Lebanon. And it turned out that he's a mishpocha. Alman's married to my wife's aunt's sister. Essentially, it's a connection. And that levaya, I shall never forget. He was killed in Lebanon in 1982. And it's just one of those things that, and he was very, very much involved with the Yeshivat Shalvim at the time, and really quite, I mean, it's a very small world, because what happened was Machla's cousin married his wife. They were cousins by marriage, because Alman and my wife's cousin were first cousins. So when the husband died, it was like a Yibum sort of situation, not quite Yibum. So the cousin married the cousin's widow. And they're just making a wedding now, so it was a very successful marriage in the end. But life is very strange. Good evening. We also have two relatives that were killed in the army, so it's one of those times of the year when you think about that. And just whatever, hopefully what we learn is Ilui Nishmatan, that all the neshamas should really be in the right place, which I'm sure they are. All right, last time we... You met my in-laws, yeah.
And
Yes,
your
yes.
brother-in-law.
Oh, yeah, my brother-in-law as well. Okay, you had a good dose of everybody.
And your nephews.
Oh, wow. No, we'll have
They're all
to...
there that day.
Very nice. Very nice. They're all in the Dead Sea, I know. My father-in-law covered in mud was something I wanted to get a picture of, but I suspect that that didn't... Actually, my mother-in-law covered in mud would have been even better. But that one, I really wasn't going there, but I have to pull their leg about that. They're good treatments. Dead Sea treatments are really very good. Good thing. All right. Back to Israel of yesteryear. Last time we actually went through essentially three prokem. We got to the end of chapter 10, which was the confirmation of Shaul. Okay, Shaul is now chosen as the king. And of course, by the end of chapter 10, there's already descent. Okay, he hasn't been in the job 5 minutes. And we saw B'nai Belial, right at the end of chapter 10, verse 27. B'nai Belial, Omru ma yosheinu zeh vayivzu v'lo yaviyu lo mincha. Who is this guy? How can he save us? They didn't bring him any sort of gift, any sort of recognition. Vayihi k'macharish, kept his peace. He was quiet. All right, didn't say anything at this point. But this is always the issue with leadership in the Jewish community. It hasn't really changed in about 3,000 years. As soon as you're appointed, there's always going to be somebody who says, why? What we didn't do last time, but what I want to do today, before we move on through Perek Yud Aleph, is to look at really probably the most classic piece of Avraham Avinu in the whole of Sefer Shmuel. I mean, there's a few classics, but this one is really classic. I can just ask you to hand those out. And what we're going to deal with is the very fundamental question of how could Shaul be chosen as the king? All right, it's to me, it's like it's classic sort of standard Hebrew. What do we call it when you learn Hebrew grammar? The first thing you learn about Hebrew grammar is that almost everything is an exception to the rule. Okay, you start learning numbers and you realize that the feminine is the masculine, the masculine is the feminine, and you're confused before you even start. And what happens is they choose a king of Israel. And we know that there is a promise to Yaakov Avinu, Yosef Shem Yehuda, okay, which seems to imply that the kings always come from the tribe Yehuda. So who's the first king from the tribe of Binyamin, right? So, this is, again, you can always say, okay, it was an exception to the rule. But,
failure.
Sorry?
He was almost like doomed to failure.
But that's the point. Was he really doomed to failure? Was it that he was doomed to failure? Or was it that, in terms of the way that he conducted himself, clearly there were issues? In other words, had it not failed, would it have gone on for a very long time? Could it? Because essentially, Yonatan, this is the biggest question later on, is that Yonatan and David have such a close relationship, and by all rights, they should have been the biggest enemies in the world. Because Yonatan was the guy who was meant to take over from Shaul. And Yonatan would have been the next king, and who takes over? David. So Yonatan should be the one who says to David, who are you to take my job? And yet, they have such a close relationship, you know, they are just so bound with each other. And Mitzvah, when we get there, we'll explain why. And it's remarkable. I mean, these are talking about very remarkable people, David and Yonatan. Yeah.
Ultimately, it will never depart the tribe of Yehuda. Correct. That doesn't mean along the way.
Along the way, correct. Well, that's a sort of suggestion that the Babino goes with. But he says something even more than that, and we'll see. Firstly, really what he's going to establish is why was Shaul fit for the job? Okay, this essentially goes back to the beginning of chapter 9, and it's really just going over some very fundamental ground. Really, when you choose a king, how do you go about finding the king? Okay? And it's got to be a tall guy, but not always. David was not, by reputation, not very tall. Okay, I mean, how tall David was, I don't know. Moshe Rabbeinu was like, you know, according to Midrashic literature, he reached the basket. You know, he could actually put the ball in from the top. If that's the way to understand it, I'm not quite sure. You know, Shlomo HaMelech, has he got a reputation being a very tall guy? I'm not sure. I don't know. Have a look at this. It's just interesting. On the first side, and we'll just look a bit at the initial suggestion. He brings this in the Rambam, right? Which this is the Barbanel in his element. The Barbanel is a commentary where it's somebody talking about kingship who lived with kings. All right, he was a man who lived in the palace. He lived in Spain, and when he talks about kings, he really knows what he's talking about. He's talking about his own life experience, and you'll see every so often it comes through in his comments. Kamosha Ra'iti says, as I saw in, you know, when I was in government in Spain. Because the Barbanel actually traditionally wrote, according to our tradition, he wrote this after he was exiled. He was exiled back to Portugal, if I'm not mistaken. So he wrote his commentary in Portugal.
He also made a famous statement to Ferdinand and Isabella when they threw the
they
wanted to stay.
They wanted to stay.
The world will remember you as the ones that started doubtful, you'll be a nothing country once we leave.
Yeah, yeah, and except for soccer, you're just about right. They're good at soccer, but not much else. Spain is, yeah, and look at Poland. I mean, you don't have to go very far to see what happens when you get rid of the Jews, and the country is... they'd never learn. The non-Jewish world just doesn't get it. They don't get it, though. If they had a base of Mikdash in Yerushalayim, it would affect the whole world. They don't get that. All right? And they make it hard for Israel. And they just don't understand. You know, what have you got to do to spell it out to these people? I just don't know. But anyway, that's for another time, another discussion. Just look at this on the right-hand side, just in this section A. Okay? Not very complicated. It's the third line down. He says that is V'yine. Natan Bazar Basiba, in other words, why was Shaul chosen? And the answer is for four reasons. Right? And he says the following. He says, Ha'achad liyot kish ishki bochai. His father was a very tough guy. Okay, he comes from a long line of very shtaka mention. And Hashem saw lekach mechalatzav ish yoshev akisa Yisrael, that he was going to have a son who was going to become somebody to sit on the throne. Kadesh yerav lo shiad Yisrael miyad plishtim, he will save the Jews from the plishtim. So, point number one, Shaul, good stock, right? Comes from a guy called Kish, Ashtarka. Ki gburata av tokid beben gburah. Okay, sort of genetic comment, right? That if the father is strong, hopefully there's good genes, there's good continuation in the son, va'omitz le'gadol, and obviously a good sense of courage, etc. Kamama ha'omish ha'susa m'shubah yitelet sus mukha, right? That if you've got a good horse, it produces, hopefully, a good horse later on, all right? This is for all those into horse breeding. That's reason number one. Second reason is interesting. Okay, if you're following me. Lefisha yasham oto bachur, shem oto bachur Shaul. Interestingly, his name was, as it were, lending itself to the situation. Not only was his name Shaul, but it means borrowed. He was a temporary king. So by his name, he was temporary. How temporary it was going to be, as I said, could have been temporary for many, many years. It really wasn't. According to the most people's calculation, apart from the Barbanel, it was 2 years. That's the whole deal. But Shaul, by the very name of the gentleman, means that he was temporary. All right? His throne will not be around forever. He's not going to be, as they say in Brooklyn, poimanim. He's not going to be poimanim. Ubezat tzipa Kadosh Baruch Hu masha atid liyot. Right? Kadosh Baruch Hu's soul was going to be. Kikei nikra haben arishon sholid adam. Kain. It gives a bit of a proof. It goes back to Kain and Hevel. Kain was established. Kinyan. Hevel was Hevel Avolim. And he's gone before he even started. So he says the name sometimes gives away the kind of the destiny of that person. If you go to the next underline here, Hasiba Shlishit, the third reason why Shaul was chosen, he was a good guy, okay, and he really had the qualities. That he behaved himself at the time when he was younger, he did not follow his desires, as it were, but he stayed with God, and he was good with people. He didn't follow his desires. He basically was somebody who was very much in control. There was nobody better than him amongst the Jewish people. So he was a really good guy. No, it wasn't enough that there wasn't another bachur v'tov. Somebody was chosen and good like him. The fact that he had achieved that all this at his particular stage of life was also unique. He was the right man for the job. And the rabbis explain, they saw that he was tov. Okay, and the rabbis say, Shenolad Mahul, that means Moshe was born with he was already brisked. Tov means he was ready for prophecy. Even at the early days, it was a sign that he was going to be a prophet. And we know that the house was filled with light. So basically, when you call somebody Tov, it doesn't just mean good, but it means that there is tremendous spiritual depth. And that's what Shaul was. Shaul was Bachur the Tov. He was chosen, he was good. Okay, and that's reason number three. And just go down to the next underlining. Hasiba revi'it liyofyo ulitiferet ta'aron. This is something very interesting. When they chose kings, they had to look the part. All right? You know, we're going through this crazy, extended, not to be understood presidential campaign. Don't ask me what's going on at the moment, because I'm trying to work out how two people from the same party can be so different about everything that they're saying. I mean, what is going on there? What do they expect afterwards? Everyone's just going to sort of kiss and make up after they've had this complete fight for, what, 9 months, a year? I don't know how long it's going on. It's crazy. And what happens is, but part of the deal is that it's all done through TV. They've got to look good, right? The president, the prime minister, they have to have a certain image. And very often they go to specialists, right, to make sure that they look right. Right haircut, the right tie at the right time. Okay, and this is something which I think we understand, the body language, the body image. And nothing has changed. Shaul looked the part. He was Yofi, he looked handsome. Tiferet Taro, and his appearance was splendid. Okay, he really looked good. And this is very interesting that a lot of this has not changed. And it says, as Leah said before, he was tall. He was head and shoulders by everybody else. Gavar Mikol Ha'am, he was above the whole crowd. Shaya Mino Nael Le Adnut, that he was seemed to be fit for leadership, the Toaro Yorel Memshala, and his height would show some sort of being able to rule. I was a very tall guy. The first principal that I worked for in England of a high school was 6'6", and it worked. You know, he didn't have to say anything, he just looked at the kids and they were terrified. And it's just because he was very tall. He wasn't particularly fierce, but he just was lucky that he had the height on his side, and you know he managed to use it to his advantage. And they've all been very short guys. I know, so I don't know what to say to you. There's a wonderful story. My father-in-law talked about short guys that he once met Begin. No, he once met Ben Gurion. And Ben Gurion is very short, so Ben Gurion, my father was not tall, but he's, I don't know, 6 foot, and Ben Gurion was very small. So and was in the Weizmann Institute in Israel. And my father went on Aliyah in 1956, and he worked in defense there. So Ben Gurion went up to him, and he said, "Who are you?" So he said, because he was being shown around, so he explained who he is. He says, "Why did you come to Israel? Why did you leave, you came from England?" So he said to him, so he just raised his kippah, because he realized Ben Gurion was so short, he didn't see the kippah. He didn't say he was wearing kippah. He said, you know, tati, etc., etc. That was the story. So Ben-Gurion was so small, he didn't see the fact he was wearing a kippah. It's very funny. The story is interesting because later on, they were visited later when Ben-Gurion handed over to, to Eshkol. Eshkol was the next prime minister. And the project was ditched within 3 months because it was cheaper to buy it from America. They were developing defense computers in the 60s, very, very early days. But the computer industry was very new in Israel. It was very expensive, and it was much cheaper to do the whole thing from the States and just buy it. And of course, that ended the project, and then that's when my wife, the whole family left Israel at that time. And they came to live here. They lived in the States. Very interesting. I mean, it's interesting, but you mentioned Ben-Gurion. He really was that tiny. Okay, sometimes good things come in small packages as opposed to large packages. I don't know what to say to you. Alright, the...
I don't think that was necessarily the criteria. That happened to be the accolades that were showered upon him.
Yeah.
But that could be Shmuel would have found the right person.
Who would have been sure. Yeah, he just, I suppose the answer is that, you know, with everything else, he says the Siba Revi'i, he doesn't say it's the main reason. He says that an extra reason he looked the part. The real reason was he had good background, he came from...
Only to set up the fall that is going to follow. He had it all and everything.
That's part of what's going on here, that's true. But at the same time, don't dismiss Shaul as being a, how should we say, an interim candidate with a negative view. He really had a lot of reasons why he should have been chosen for the king, to become the king. And that's really important to understand. What he does say, however, which is so interesting, and this is the question at the bottom, okay, if you're with me, from the bottom of that paragraph, of that column, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, it's 10 lines up, the Omnom, where it says the word wrong tribe. And this is the question we're asking. Shaul was chosen, and he was from the wrong tribe, the Omnom. He says, however, Im hayazeh bilti ra'oi mipat shifto, in the end of the day, isn't the king meant to come from the tribe of Yehuda? In which case, how could you choose Shaul from the tribe of Binyamin to be the first king? You know, if you're doing the first guy and you're making him an exception to the rule, it doesn't really give the rule a lot of force. On that, there are various answers. Kotava Ramban. Now, what he does is that he brings the Ramban, who talks about this actually on the Pasuk of Lo Yoseh Shevet Miyehuda. And what the Ramban says over there is that, and you'll see, it's just as the next underlining. Lo Yoseh Shevet Miyehuda, Shehazaken Yaakov Avinu Alav HaShalom, Niba, Yaakov had a prophecy, Sheyeh HaMelucha Mimenu Tamid, that the kingdom will always come from him, V'lo Yimshol Echa Me'echav Alav, nobody would rule over Yehuda. In other words, what will happen is that eventually, you know, Yehuda will always be in charge. Doesn't necessarily mean, I suppose, that he will always be the king, but he will always be the brother who is, as it were, in charge of everybody else. V'chein kol mechokei b'Yisrael asher lo tabat ha-melech mimenu yeh. B'shevet Yehuda Yimshol v'yitzaveh b'Yisrael tamid. He basically is saying that as a tribe, Yehuda will always be an influential group, always. V'lo chotem ha-malchut ad sheyovo shiloh, the second column, v'lo yikatamim kulam lasot b'em kirtzono v'zeh melech ha-mashiach. And Yehuda will carry it right through to the Mashiach. V'amar ha-rav sh'ashevet shezachar b'katuv ramaz l'malchut David sheyeh melech ha-rishon mi-beit Yehuda. Basically, what he's saying is that eventually what was going to happen is that the kingship was going to go to David, who was going to be from the tribe of Yehuda, and then it was never going to leave Yehuda. Once it arrives at David's door, it never ever goes away. But before it gets there, all right, it's going to travel around. And this is the next underlining, which I've got in the middle of that column. So now, what does the Ramban do with Shaul? Omar kilbavu shaya sheilat ha-malchut. Because the request for the king, as we spoke about last time, was something which was not very desirable at the time when it was made, basically it was a sign of displeasure from God that who was chosen as the first king, Shaul, wasn't going to be the permanent king, because the whole request was not really done at the right time. It wasn't done in the right way. That is very fascinating, and it links in very much what I spoke about on Shabbos as well, which we'll get to, Mirza Shem. I gave a shiur on Shabbos also here, when we spoke a bit about chapter 12, which we'll get to maybe next week. And he says, "V'natan lahem malchut sha'a." So the whole thing of Sha'ul was in fact that it was a temporary fix. So according to the Ramban, it's a temporary fix. But what the Ramban says, essentially, is that the kingship, once it arrives at Yehuda, will never leave Yehuda. Now if you turn over, and I'm just jumping you through this, because the Ababina, bless him, as they say, had a lot to say, and he wrote it, and he kept writing, and he kept writing. A bit like the Moshe Feinstein. When did he have time to write all that stuff? You know, you ask yourself, when did he do this? It's interesting, because I once heard a story of the Achiezer. The Achiezer was Chaim Ozugrodzinski, who was the great Gaon of Vilna till the war. He died in 1940, before the Germans got there, but he passed away at that time. And he wrote this phenomenal responsa, Achiezer's three volumes, and it's phenomenal. He really wrote about a lot of interesting things. And everybody wanted to know, when did he have time to do this? Because he was the Rav who answered Shilas 24 hours a day. And apparently, in between, he could get his mind fixed in such a way that in between people coming in to ask him all day long, he would write another two lines of the responsa. Now, how could you do that? That's multitasking. Men usually are not good at that. All right? You know, women can do that brilliantly, but men don't do multitasking very well. And he could do multitasking. It was unbelievable. And I believe Ramosha was the same. You know, Ramosha would have phone calls from who knows where all the time. He used to pick up the phone himself. In the 60s, Ramosha would pick up, if you called him, he would actually answer the phone himself. Eventually, he got smart, I suppose, and he had a secretary, somebody to do it for him. Because, you know, there's a limit. How much can you... can you pick up the phone to answer these questions? He did answer them, but he would take time. So again, you know, in between all of that, they had the tremendous concentration to be able to go back to what they were learning and continue writing. It's remarkable. And the Ababina, I guess, was the same in his day. He wrote this commentary, which was so expansive. And one wonders, you know, in between sort of all the matters of state that he might have been dealing with, he was already working out, you know, all the ideas that eventually he was going to write down in this particular book. It's spectacular. He says like this. He's got a different take on the whole thing. He says, you know what? He says, I'm going to go back to basics. I don't agree with the Ramban. The Ramban says Lo Yoseh Shem Yehuda means that there has to be a kingship from Yehuda, and it's about kingship. He says, you know what? As far as I'm concerned, says the Barbanel, Lo Yoseh Shem Yehuda has got a completely different track. He says, Yehuda is always going to be an important tribe. The Ramban said this. But he says that what actually it means is that Shevet doesn't necessarily mean kingship. Shevet means leadership. And what he's saying is that as a tribe, Yehuda is always going to be the tribe that all the other tribes look up to. When you see later on that they do a head count of the Jewish people, it's going to be everybody and Yehuda. And that happens many times. It's already started happening in Sefer Shoftim, we saw that. So Yehuda is always going to have like a separate existence. And he says something even more dramatic. He says that when the Beis HaMikdash is going to be destroyed, and we know it got destroyed and the tribes were exiled before that, who's left? Yehuda, right? With a bit of Binyamin thrown in. And that's it. And Le'yosu Shem Yehuda, he says that as a tribe, Yehuda will never disappear. It's an interesting suggestion. And he says that was the Nevuah. Now, does it mean that the kings have to come from Yehuda, says the Barbanel? No. As far as he's concerned, if there's somebody who's fit to be king who is not Yehuda, but he is Binyamin, and he has the right credentials and whatever, he'll become the king. And he doesn't like to give Shaul a kind of, as the word we'd use, b'dieved, you know, sort of second-rate situation. As far as he's concerned, at the moment when Shaul was chosen, he was absolutely the right guy for the job. Absolute. Yes?
What would their Barbanel do with Matisyahu, etc.
And
Chazal say that he took away the Lo Yoseh Shem Yehuda, they were all.
Yeah, the Ramban mentions it, of course, and he actually, that proves his point. The Ababinel, I think, gets away with it by saying that once, again, like the Ramban says, he will agree that once it does arrive at Yehuda's door, it never leaves. All right, that's the Lo Yoseh Shem Yehuda. Eventually, it will arrive. But it doesn't mean automatically that it has to start at Yehuda's door. So once it arrives, then of course that's the problem of the Chashmonaim, because they usurp the throne. Okay, and that's why they gain our praise, but they also gain a bit of, how should we say, there's a bit of a grey area there, to put it very mildly. So have a look at this. I just want to show you inside, because Ababinel is, as I said, is a phenomenon. The way he writes and the way that he's prepared to ask questions, which are really quite to the point. I mean, more than to the point. Where we're going to read on the second side, and again, I'm just taking a bit out of it. It's about halfway down. It's underlined. So he says that basically what just a further up the page where it's underlined Shevet Yehuda. It says like this: Hayah Shevet Yehuda Tamid Nimne Bifnei Atzmo. The tribe of Yehuda was always counted by itself. The Lo Nitzpalim Sha'ar Shvatim Lemalato, and was not included with the other tribes. Omar Binyan Yavesh Gilad. We have it with the story of Yavesh Gilad, which is coming up. Biyeh Bnei Yisrael Shlosh Mot Ele Veish Yehuda Shloshim Ele. Yehuda is counted separately as 30,000. Omar Binyechemet Amalek. We're going to read later on in chapter 15. Vayifkedeim Batlaim Matayim Elef Ragli. Vaseret Alafim Edish Yehuda. There were 200,000 troops and 10,000 of Yehuda. Ramah b'sof zeh sefer mispar ah, when he counts the people at the end of Shmuel Bet, but to Yisrael shmona meot elef ish, the Jews were 800,000, the ish Yehuda chamesh meot elef, and the Yehuda was 500,000. So his point is the Yosef Shem Yehuda means Yehuda will always have a unique position in the history of the Jewish people, that they will always be like a separate group, like the, I suppose you would call them almost the aristocracy of the Jewish people. If you want to use that word. I don't like using that word because it has all the French revolution connections. But the reality is that's what it seems to be. Maybe in the spiritual sense. It becomes very, very interesting. I just want to just throw one idea to you, because later on what happens is that obviously when David takes over, and he is from the tribe of Yehuda, he is required. One of the things it says is that he goes to visit his brothers, right, at the front line. The story with David and Goliath. And what happens there is so interesting that it uses a word that he goes to bring to his brothers. It uses a Hebrew word, arubatam. Arubatam comes from the word arev, means a guarantee. So the rabbis are very perplexed. What is he bringing his brothers? So some say he's going to get some sort of, he's bringing them money. Some say to pay off their debts, because they had to raise money to buy their weapons. Believe it or not, that's what the army was like in those days. And he says there is one concept, the Mefarshim explained, that David realized that there was a historical guarantee from the days of Yehuda towards Binyamin. Very interesting. What happened was that when Yehuda and Binyamin was being called down to Mitzrayim by Yosef, Yehuda went to his father and said that I will be the guarantor of Binyamin. If you remember the story from Miketz. And at that point, Yehuda became the guarantor, the person responsible for the tribe of Binyamin. What happens later on is that guarantee is fulfilled with David being responsible for Shaul. Interesting, because David was the tribe of Yehuda, and Shaul the tribe of Binyamin. And of course, go through history a bit further down the line. What happens to Mordechai? Right? What is Mordechai made up of? Right? He's Ishimini. He's Binyamin, but he's also Ish Yehudi. He's from Yehuda. So the suggestion is his father was Benjamin, his mother was from Yehuda. So he, again, there is this kind of, in one person, the concept of the guarantee of Yehuda being responsible for the rest of the Jewish people, essentially for Binyamin. Because by the time we get down the line, that's all that's left. Okay, although nowadays, of course, they're all coming back from all over the place. But in those days, that was it. So what I'm saying is that once Yehuda is established, Yehuda becomes kind of the historical guarantor for the future of the Jewish people. All right, and that, again, is a very interesting and very, very important theme, which runs a lot right the way through, almost, I would say, certainly goes through the Purim story, which is ready in the after the destruction of the First Temple, and probably even beyond that. I mean, you could probably link it up with Yehuda Nasi as well. I don't know. I haven't gone that far, but it's kind of an interesting thing.
Usually they learn not from Yehuda, correct? Yes.
Because until you get to the point of the establishment of the final king of who's going to be Yehuda and it's going to remain Yehuda, it can be from anywhere. And all the Shoftim were coming from all over the place, right? I think, what was it? There were Menashe, there was all different tribes, right? Because that was the point. Even you go back to Moshe Rabbeinu, who had the status of a king, he used to try to leave it. So the answer is that until you get to David, until that person of Yehuda, that caliber, is established, and then it becomes permanently fixed in the tribe of Yehuda, it goes all over the place. And that's essentially what the Abarbanel says, that number one, Yehuda is special. La Yosef Shem Yehuda will always be a special count. And number two, Lo Hashem Yehuda, that also what he said, as we pointed out, that he will survive, he will be around through history. Okay? As one of the tribes that actually survives. So it doesn't mean, as and the Abarbanel says at the end, I'll just read to the end thing here, where he says quite clearly that you thought it meant that all the kings of Israel have to come from Yehuda. The answer is no. Eventually, David, who takes over, establishes the kingship for Yehuda, and then it becomes a permanent thing with David. But before that, it could go anywhere. So it would have gone to Shaul. It could have gone, who knows? All right. And if Shaul had, and this is what we're saying, that if it had worked out with Shaul properly, then it would have gone to his son, and it would have continued through Binyamin, who knows till when. All right, until, and may not have been David, I mean, in the end of the day, it might have been somebody else. So this is kind of interesting. Lo Yosheshem Yehuda, according to what we normally understood was a prophecy about kingship, says the Barbanel, no, he disagrees. It's not a prophecy about kingship per se, it's a prophecy about leadership. Who is going to be the tribe who's going to be the most significant tribe amongst the Jewish people? The answer is Yehuda. And that's a very fascinating thing. And that, of course, explains why we're called Yehudim, right? That's the whole thing. And again, very big themes there in the Megillah, mityahadim, right? This is the expression that is used, there's a lot of stuff to say here, but you know, really for another time. Just have a look at the end here. I'll just read the last paragraph over here on the left hand side, and I think this is just really sums up his whole point. It's about five lines from the bottom. Hinei bi'arti, underline. Hinei bi'arti she'en adav kemoshe chashem hamforshim. Right, he says that. I now explain to you, this is completely different to the way everybody learns. Why was Shaul chosen? For the purpose of continuing his kingship. There was no second-rate situation with Shaul. He wasn't been chosen as a kind of stopgap so that, you know, when somebody good comes along, you can take over. He was the absolute choice at the beginning. He was the right guy. And it's not, as it were, rejecting the blessing of Yaakov, the lo bitul mipat shivto, or rejecting the concept of the tribe. And this answers his basic question. So basically, what the Abarbanel does over here, which is so interesting, is that he redefines what something that, you know, for us, I think, until I learned this, I always assumed the kings always be Yehuda. The answer is, it's not so straightforward. Even something as basic as that is obviously up for discussion. What I do when I teach this, of course, is talk about Shidduchim. Alright, how do I talk about Shidduchim? Because, you know, I'm talking to a whole group of young ladies who seem to be, unfortunately, going through that very unpleasant experience for most of them. And I say, look, what is the whole thing of Shaul all about? Shaul is all about who he was. It's not about where we said originally where he came from, but the Ikka was, as the Barbanel says, he was the right guy. He had the right character. I said, when you go with that list of questions on a Shidduch, wanting to know the background, wanting to know this, wanting to know what shul, wanting to know whatever, without trying to find out who the person is, then you're wasting your time. All right? And I get this message, and they all look at me sort of rather shocked. You know, Rabbi, you're the first rabbi ever told us that. You know, I think, doesn't anybody tell anybody these? Because, you know, you hear these Shidduch stories, and the whole thing is that you've got to sort out the Yichas before you even meet. And it's madness. There is a mad situation going on there, and it's actually, if anything, it's getting worse. I'd like to think that the situation was improving, but I'm not convinced that it is, even with all the publicity that is going on. And my argument here is that Shaul was not about his yichus, really, wasn't about anything to do with, even with about his tribe, because he wasn't really the right tribe, according to whatever we're saying here. The reality is it was all about him. It was about who he was. And he was the right guy at the right time, and we know, and we found out about him, and unless, and you know, just sort of later on, unfortunately, because of the events that took place, which was a problem in his character, had we not found that out, it would have had not happened, he would have continued, and his son would have continued, and it would have been a dynasty for how long? Who really knows? And that's a very interesting concept, the idea of actually trying to find out who the person is himself. Whether it has any effect on these young ladies, I'm not sure, but I just wanted to get off my chest, because I was really frustrated about some of the stories they came out with. Any comments about that? Can I hear this? This is very, very important. Yeah.
So what Malchus Yahu did, what the Hashmonam did, was in and of itself not wrong. It was wrong to continue past the stage of Harasha.
But again, once you've established Malchus Yehuda, even the Barbanel will say that it stays with Yehuda. Right? It's not necessarily going to have to go to him, but once it's in their particular camp, that's it. And what the Hashmonaim did in terms of establishing their kingship, at the beginning maybe made sense, because maybe who else was around? You know, you could argue, you could go back to the Shaul example. It was the right person at the time. But clearly, at that period in Jewish history, it was not the time to start reinventing the wheel. The wheel had already been established. The kingship had already been established. So it was wrong. And it becomes very, very challenging later on. The Malchus really falls down. I mean, you know, as much as we know about it, it's a disaster. But by the time you get 100 years down the line, Julius Caesar, wasn't it, who came into Jerusalem? They'd already lost it in 63 BCE, if I'm not mistaken. Didn't Caesar arrive in Jerusalem or somebody like that? And that was it. And then the kingdom of Israel was basically done for, and the Romans took over. Yes, sorry.
But wasn't it their mistake was that they were Kohanim, and they couldn't be both Kohanim and...
That's the big problem, and it's more, even more delicate than that, because... you know, it was mixing the metaphors, right? What exactly the Kohen was meant to do, as opposed to a Melech. You know, we have here separation of, you know, sort of powers of different, you know, checks and balances, and we understand in America it's very, very defined. In Israel it was, and they blurred, well, it's supposed to work, but they blurred the barriers completely. And it became a very big problem, because then the Kohen Gadol became a political appointment. And I don't quite know how they got life insurance, I really don't know. Because it seemed to be, as soon as they went into the Beis HaMikdash on Yom Kippur, inevitably they would die. Who would take that job in the first place? I really don't know. And there is a number which I read once, that 300 Kohanim Gedolim in the period, during the Second Temple period, right? You know, that's a lot. 300 sort of they got through, whereas in the First Temple period, my guess is it wasn't anywhere near that number. And you get this story about Yochanan Kohen Gadol, you know, after 80 years, he becomes Tzedukah. I mean, it's unbelievable. All right, you know, there's stuff going on there which really, really, really does blow the mind. But I wanted to share this with you because I think this is really such a yesod. It's such a fundamental in understanding. I mean, it's essentially, in the end, everybody comes to the same conclusion that once it hits David, it stays with David. But before that, the understanding of Lo Yosef Shem Yehuda is really up for grabs. And I think this is important. What I want to do very briefly, because we have a few minutes, I just want to look at chapter 11 so that we continue moving on. And we'll see that here Shaul basically moves into new territory. Basically, Shaul has gone from being questioned to be the king. We left chapter 10 with the Bnei Belial, these very sort of unscrupulous men, whatever that means, and they basically question. So look what happens in chapter 11. It's a good story just by itself. And we'll just read through Pesuk. It's not a long chapter. So Pesuk Aleph, Vayam Nochash Amoni. So this guy Nochash appears out of nowhere. An Ammonite, right? But Yichana Yavish Gilad, and he makes an encampment against the place called Yavish Gilad. But Yomer Kolanshe Yavish El Nachash. So they say to this guy, Karat Lanu Brit V'Navdecha. Right, we're going to give in. We're immediately going to make a peace treaty, and we will become your slaves, your servants. This is very much in line with the previous sort of events that we would have read about in Sefer Shoftim to a certain extent. But Yomer Alem Nachash Amoni. So he had a price. He said, yeah. Okay, I agree. B'zot echrod lahem, I will agree to make this covenant. B'nekor lachem kol ein yamin. On one condition, that you all blind yourselves in your right eye. Not a very nice thing to do. Okay, he's basically, as far as he's concerned, I'm going to press my rights here, but I'm going to push it to an extreme. But samtia cherpa kol Yisrael, it will become a blemish on the whole of the Jewish people. And at this point in time, of course, they are in real trouble because they made the first overture to him. He's agreed with this impossible condition. And they said, give us time. All right? We're going to think about it. Vayomer elav ziknei yavesh heref lanu shivat yamin. We need a week. V'nishacham malachim b'chol gvul Yisrael. Will send messengers throughout the whole of the border of Israel, probably meaning to find whether they're going to come and support us against you. All right? Meaning, not telling him that, obviously, give us a week. And they then sent all these messengers around to see if they can raise an army. Nobody can save us. We will go out to you. Basically, what they're saying is that, you know, give us a bit of time and we'll see whether we can stand up to you or not. And of course, this guy Nachash has got the upper hand. And he thinks that he's won the battle without even fighting. And that's so interesting. So they come to Shaul. They speak to the people. The people started crying. So even though they've asked for a king, And remember, we had a whole discussion about what was the purpose of the king, to get a general of the army, which is really what they wanted. When it comes to the crunch, they're completely, they're not there, right? They're crying. The immediate reaction is, we can't do anything about this, and we're sunk. And at this point in time, this is where Shaul lifts the nation completely into a new situation. And to his credit, this is why Shaul, you know, at the beginning has such potential. He is really head and shoulders above people. That means he raises them up. It reminds me of the idea of the hands of Moshe was raised to God. All right, when the hands were up there, then they were looking to Shammai. And you get the impression that when they looked towards Shaul, it really was looking towards Shammai. That's sort of similar idea. All right, it was looking upwards. Literally, the physical representation is a spiritual, has a spiritual connotation. It's the way I've always sort of thought of it, and I think it makes sense here. Look at this. Hey, v'hinei Shaul ba'ach re'a baka min ha-sadeh. So in the meantime, he's plowing his field. V'yomer Shaul ma'ala am ki yivka. Why are the people crying? V'yisapru lo divrei Anshei Yavesh, and they told him the whole story. And here comes something interesting. V'tislach ruach elokim al Shaul. And the Targum always translates this in different ways, but here, Sharad ruach gevura. Shaul was filled with a spirit of strength. And it was from God. When he heard these words, he got very angry, as everyone would. And what did he do? He was angry not only at the Nachash, he was angry at the people. He says, you know, why are you giving in? What are you doing here? And not only that, but why are the people so already conciliatory? Why don't we stand? Why don't we make a fight? And he made a tremendous example, and of course it's very, very ironic. You remember the end of Sefer Shoftim, the Pelegesh Begivah, that awful story when they actually send the body of the woman in bits around the country to make the point about the fact that they should have respected her and respected the situation so much more, and they didn't. So now Shaul Yud does the same thing with an animal to bring the people together. It's kind of a ironic historical moment, because he's using the same method. Instead of his tribe being rejected, he's using it from the point of view of being the king at this point to establish himself as a method of bringing the people together, right? And it's kind of a kapara. This is really a kapara. And it's so interesting.
Also something with Rispa and Absarim,
so you can link it back to that as well. I mean, the whole idea of this, you know, cutting animals into bits and pieces was very significant to them. Mm-hmm. To us, it seems, I don't know, kind of weird. All right? Because we don't make covenants. We don't make, we make a deal. We sign and we shake hands, right? We have different ways of doing it. In those days, they did it with this, with animals, and two halves make a whole. Okay, I mean, that's usually the way it was done. Or in this case, more than bit, you know, all the bits come together. So look what he does, Pasuk Zayin. He cuts, he takes this yoke of oxen, and he basically, obviously, he slaughters the animals, and then he cuts them up. He sends them to all the borders of Israel through their messengers, saying, interesting that he includes Shmuel in this. All right, very politically correct, and very significant that he would include Shmuel. I mean, he's the king, but his power source is still very much reliant on the respect that the people have for Shmuel. If you don't follow Shaul and Shmuel, Kor Yosef Bekoro, this is what's going to happen to that your animals. In other words, basically, I would say not just your animals, but you. All right, because this guy is prepared to cut up the people of Yavesh Gilad. Who knows what he's going to do next to everybody else. All right, I think this is really the message. The fear of God fell upon the people, and they all get together as one man, and they go out. It's a great story. Here comes an interesting challenge. He counted them in Bezek. All right, Bezek is my favorite word in Israel. When I was living there, it was the name of the phone company. And Bezek was, I used to call them Nezek, because that was much more suitable than Bezek, because they really used to... damage control was the worst thing about them. Chevrat Nezek, it was a wonderful experience going to deal with them. I don't know if they're still, I don't know who it is these days. It probably is Bezek.
BZEQ,
yeah, it's still there. Bezek dot whatever it is now, dot org. Dot ill. Okay, you've got to have ill at the end. But it's interesting. Those days, as they say in the yeshiva, is a shtickle Torah. What's the shtickle Torah? But Yifkadein Babazek is that, you'll see Rashi. Yifkadein Babazek, Rashi says, Rabbateinu Amru, B'shivrei Charsit, that he counted them with bits of earthenware. In other words, what is this all about? It's back to the whole issue, can you count Jews directly or indirectly, right? We count a minion, Hoshea Temecha, and when the minion turns up, right, in the morning, then the Olam is here. The Olam is alright. And if you're number 10, you're the Olam. This has always been a very standard way of describing it. But what Rashi is pointing out here is that this is an old tradition going back to Shaul, when he was counting the people, he didn't want to count them direct. And that's a whole thing to do with Ayin Hora, that you don't want to bring an evil eye against Am Yisrael, right? That's the reason why you don't do it. And that's why originally in the count of the first count in Sefer Shemot, it was done with half shekel. Because it was done in such a way that it should be indirect. Okay? And that was the reason. Says the Abarbanel, interestingly on that particular point, that this is absolute lokshen. He says he doesn't agree with it whatsoever. Counting Am Yisrael, he says, forget about Ayin Horas, forget about all of that stuff, you should count Am Yisrael, there's no issue with it whatsoever. Why did they have the half shekel count? You know, he says something very obvious. He said it was fundraiser. He said, very simple. He said it wasn't through the counting the people, it was raising money. Everybody should give a bit of money towards the Mikdash. And as far as the Barbanel is concerned, he doesn't go with this whole idea. He would not have any issue, I think, from his perspective, counting a minion, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. But we traditionally don't do that. So one of the proofs is from Shaul, that Shaul vayifgadein babazeh, either bazeh means name of a place, so there's no proof from anywhere, or bazeh, as Rashi says here, that he used indirect means of counting the Jewish people, bits of pottery or something like that, through which he would be able to count them. And it's interesting because later on with Amalek it's the same problem. Vayifgadein batla'im, it says over there, he counted them with sheep. All right, and again, the same question is asked. Was it indirect? Maybe Tla'im is the name of a place. And I saw Rav Goren says over there that Tla'im is significant because it was Korban Pesach. All right, he says that he counted them in sheep because they were going to do the Korban Pesach before the Battle of Amalek, which is so interesting. And Mitzvah, when we get there, I'll share that with you because there's a whole shtickle Torah on that as well. So whatever way you understand it, Vayifgadein Babazek, he either counted them in a place called Bazek, or he counted them indirectly, because if you say it was the place, maybe he counted them directly. All right, you understand what I'm saying? If you reject the idea of indirect and say it's just the name of a place, then maybe he counted them directly. And there's a whole issue later on with David HaMelech doing something which at the end of Shmuel Bet, if you look it up, look up there, the whole Psukim, you'll see there's a big problem, because he seems to count the people directly, and it seems to be Yoav says you did something wrong. There's a whole world here which we can talk about maybe on another occasion. I'm going to go with the translation over here. He counted them in Bezek, in the name of a place. But I just want to sort of show you that, you know, ready from Rashi, there is a different way of understanding this. Posachet. I want to finish the chapter. Yechidem bebezek v'yu b'nei Yisrael shlosh meret elev v'ish Yehuda shlosh melech. Here we go again. The men of Yehuda, 30,000. 330,000 men altogether. V'yom el malachim abayim. So they said to the messengers, "Kotaron leisha veshgilad, machat tielano teshua kechom hashemesh." All right, there's going to be a salvation by the heat of the sun. All right, and I think this is kind of again an allusion. Where was the great victory by the heat of the sun? Go back to Sefer Yehoshua, right? Shemesh beGivon Dom. It was in Givon. They had the sun was at the zenith. It was at the height, and that was the great victory that they had then. And I think Shaul is aware of the historical precedent here and wants to recreate it again. They were very happy. Of course they were happy. You know, the optometrists were not going to get extra work. Tomorrow we'll go out. You'll do exactly what you promised. He already had the tactic. He put the army into three different groups. They went early in the morning. They beat the Ammonites till the middle of the day. Whoever was left ran away. Not even two of them remain. All right. Again, overtures here of Parah when after the Yamsuf. Lo nishar ad echad. Which all rabbis always say that adechad means that Paro survived. Okay, we always want to have somebody to sort of give evidence, not just from our side, but maybe from the other side as well. But here, lo nishar shnayim yachad. Vayama amel Shmuel, so they said to Shmuel, not to Shaul, they said to Shmuel, mi ha omer Shaul yimloch aleinu, tenu anashim v'nemitem. Now this is interesting, because the people now felt that the ones who had rejected Shaul at the end of chapter 10, now needed to be punished because they were moreid b'malchut. And at this point in time, they were talking to Shmuel, and it seems that Shaul preempted, and this is a very significant moment. Vayomer Shaul lo yumat ish bayom hazeh. Nobody's going to die today. Ki hayom asa Hashem teshuva b'Yisrael. It's a day of salvation. And the rabbis, again, are very significant over here in their comments, because they seem to suggest Shaul had to do something, and he didn't. He missed the opportunity. Shaul is, the comment about Shaul later on is that he's cruel to be kind, and he's kind to be cruel. Alright, he doesn't get the balance right, and it's very difficult, believe me. Being in leadership is not easy to get that balance, and sometimes you're too much one way, too much the other way, and this is Shaul. At the beginning, we can see there's going to be problems. So what does Shmuel say? And we're just going to finish up. So Shmuel says to the people, we're going to go to Gilgal, because at this point in time, it's now time to establish the kingship for everybody. They did a tremendous celebration in Gilgal. Why Gilgal? Because that's the first place where they conquered Eretz Yisrael. They came in at Gilgal. And Gilgal was a place that they always returned to. Later on, Eliyahu Navi, where does he go to? Before he goes to Shemayim, he goes to Gilgal. All right, because that is always going to be significant. It's where they had the stones which they pulled out of the Yarden, and they wrote the Torah on the they left stones in the Yarden. They pulled other stones out and they wrote the whole Torah there. This was a significant place. You don't have Jerusalem at this point, but Gilgal is about as good as it gets. Vayisbechu sham zvachim shlamim livnei Hashem. They made these sacrifices. Vayismach sham Shaul v'chol anshei Yisrael ad meod, and everybody was very happy. It was a great party. And as a consequence of this, you can see that Shaul is established as the Melech, and as we would hope at this point, without discussion. Shmuel in chapter 12, and this Mr. Shem we'll see next week, gives us a big surprise, because he goes back to the old complaint, you shouldn't have asked for a king when you did. You would think by this point in time, Shaul is established, he's shown his prowess to be able to lead the army, everyone is happy over here, they've got a fantastic victory, and you'll see when you look at chapter 12, Mr. Shem will do next week, we'll see that this becomes again a very serious problem. Shmuel never gets out of his mind the fact that he was rejected, felt that it may have been a rejection of God, not necessarily just of Shmuel, but in fact of Hashem. And we'll see, Mitzvah Hashem, next week what happens. An unbelievable chapter. If you've never read chapter 12, read it. Because there is a nace which happens over here in chapter 12, which defies imagination. I mean, the miracle of winning wars is one thing. But what Shmuel does before he dies is, without doubt, one of the greatest stories in the Bible. Totally unknown. People don't know about this. They know about David and Goliath. Everybody knows that story. But chapter 12 of Shmuel Aleph is a story that, if you haven't read it, please read ahead. And Mitzvah Hashem, we'll come back to this next week. Okay, everybody, have a good week and a great Yom Ha'atzmaut and Yom Ha'atzmaut Sameach to everybody.
If anyone doesn't know, Peter Weissman is recovering.